It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a proposed hog farm in northern Wisconsin would be the largest in the state. And this week, the DNR said it'll review the plan for environmental concerns. We'll get the details.
First, a recent opinion piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel called for education leaders to review Wisconsin's college reciprocity agreements with Minnesota and other states.
Reciprocity agreements allow students from out of state to come to Wisconsin's colleges for lower tuitions than the usual out-of-state tuition. Same goes for Wisconsin students who go to college in those other states.
Our guest believes that while these arguments are generally a good thing, it wouldn't hurt to review them more regularly to make sure they're a good deal for Wisconsin students and for taxpayers.
We're joined now by Michael Flaherty. He's a professional communications specialist and a senior lecturer in life sciences communication at UW-Madison. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
So first, give us the basics. How many reciprocity agreements is Wisconsin a part of now?
Well, it's three separate states, and it involves about 10% of the UW system population. So it's a huge number. It's about 18,000 students. There's a separate agreement with UW-Platteville in Iowa and Illinois. There's a second one, part of the Midwest Higher Education Compact, which is with seven states. And then we have a longstanding agreement with Minnesota, in which our students exchange in-state tuition to attend each other's universities.
And when people think of reciprocity, I think people usually think of the Wisconsin-Minnesota agreement, right?
That's correct.
So what was the thinking? What's the rationale behind having these things in place?
Well, the thinking was early on with the Minnesota agreement that Minnesota had opportunities and we had opportunities that the other states didn't have. For example, Minnesota had a veterinarian school and I believe it's a pharmacy school that we didn't have. So it made a lot of sense to share resources at the time. Over time, it became a great opportunity for students, if it wasn't handy to go to one school, to go to the other. It's been a pretty good deal and a fairly equitable deal for most of the history of the agreement.
So that's the key word there, I think, equitable, that you're concerned about. All in all, usually it's balanced out how much it costs, say, Wisconsin to be part of this deal, how much it costs Minnesota, you know, in the long run?
Right. There's no smoking gun here. Everybody involved in this are good people. These things get renegotiated every year and get readjusted. I think the Minnesota agreement's been adjusted something like 40 times in the last 50 years. But what's happened is, in all three of those compacts, that a lot more of out-of-state students are coming here than our students are going there. And it depends on how you measure the cost of educating a student. The full cost, with everything included, it's way more expensive to educate a student than the student pays in tuition. So therefore, that would not be a good deal for Wisconsin taxpayers. By a lot of other measures, it is a good deal. And it really comes back to depend on how you measure what it costs to educate a student.
But that's your worry, that if we're not taking a close look at that, we may be paying out more than the other states and not getting a benefit from it.
Well, what the paper basically says, it was a white paper for the Policy Research Institute that said, let's just take another look at this. Let's make sure that what we're doing makes sense for Wisconsin taxpayers, and let's make sure we're looking at all the costs. Now, there's a lot of benefits that aren't necessarily in a cost-benefit ratio either. Having a fully functioning four-year university in a small town like River Falls is an enormous benefit to the western Wisconsin economy. That's part of it, and you can't overlook that.
Let's key in on a campus like that. There are some along the Minnesota border that how much do they rely on Minnesota students coming in as part of their student bodies there?
Well, at River Falls, it's almost half their student body is from Minnesota. I believe at Superior, I think it's like a third. I think at Menominee, at Stout, which is also on the border, it's probably a fourth. And roughly those numbers. Maybe it's a fifth. But it's significant. And River Falls, I'm guessing if they didn't have reciprocity, if Minnesota students weren't so prevalent, they might even have to close their doors.
Well, and that's one of the arguments for keeping these reciprocity deals in place more or less as they are, right? That these communities would be hurt by a possible loss of students, maybe potentially a loss of those campuses.
Well, the broader question is, we have a 26-campus system, 13 four-year and 13 two-years. What did we build these for? I mean, taxpayers have a tremendous investment in these campuses. Did we build them to educate students from other state at a deep discount? Are we in the education business for other students? And I'm not making a claim either way. It's just to say, let's back up and make sure we're counting all the costs and see whether this is a wise thing for us to be doing.
We're talking to Michael Flaherty about a piece he wrote. It was in the Journal Sentinel, also a paper he wrote on the topic of reciprocity agreements for tuition between Wisconsin and Minnesota, as well as some other agreements out there. Says it's time maybe to revisit them, make sure Wisconsin is getting what it pays for. So if we did this, if we took this close look, tried to measure it by good metrics, what kind of changes do you think we'd make? Is it like a tweak here and there to renegotiate these, or are there deals that maybe we'd be better off without?
Well, I think it bears study. I think what's going to happen is the Minnesota agreement will be tweaked, as it has been tweaked in the past. We paid Minnesota this year $1.9 million just to make up the difference in tuition between the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus and UW-Madison. That goes away this year already. That's already been agreed. We also paid Minnesota $6 million in cash to balance out the differences in marginal education costs, and I'm not going to go into that formula because I don't even – no, I'm just kidding. Most people don't understand what it is, and it would take the bulk of your show to explain it.
Right.
But so that will be renegotiated and possibly could be eliminated. Minnesota students paid $115 million in tuition last year. Wisconsin paid $85 million to attend those schools. That's a $30 million difference, and you could argue that's a $30 million injection into our economy. And that doesn't include what they paid for dorms. So all those students help lower the overall cost of these infrastructure projects, which would be part of the calculation, which is way above, you know, my level of understanding and ability to.
So one concern people have about Wisconsin campuses is if we're making it easier for out-of-state students to come in, does that mean we're losing spots for in-state students whose parents presumably have been paying state taxes to help pay for the university all along? Is that something you're trying to weigh here?
The two campuses that are difficult to get into are UW-Eau Claire and UW-Madison. For Madison, it's a wash. About the same number of our students attend Minnesota schools or the University of Minnesota, has come here. So that's roughly a wash. Eau Claire is tough to get in. It's a really good school. In the other campuses, it's actually beneficial because, as I said, for River Falls, well, take Platteville, for example. They signed this agreement with two other states. With the added revenue, which is about $180 million, they were able to build new dorms, new buildings, add faculty. They become a much stronger school as a result of having this infusion of student dollars and student body.
Is this an issue that's at the front of mind for legislators now when they've got a lot of other big budget things, or even in the off season when they can get into some of those minutiae?
Well, this is something that gets revisited every year. It is fair to say they have much broader things on their agenda right now. This was part of the debate when Governor Walker introduced his budget, because he gave the authority to negotiate these deals to this newly created public authority, which was in his budget. That spurred the debate over reciprocity, but when the public authority debate went away, so did the debate over reciprocity and who would negotiate that.
So you've got this op-ed, you've got this paper out. Is this being taken seriously? Are people saying, yeah, we need to take a serious look and make these changes?
Well, I guess the broader question is the taking a look at the 26 campus system. And we also have 17 technical college. We have a huge higher education infrastructure. We're probably 7th or 8th, maybe 9th per capita in the nation in what we invest in higher education for a state that's about between 32nd and 38th in economy. Have we overbuilt? And is there a broader question here that we should be looking at in terms of efficiently investing in our higher education system? Now, I teach a college at the class at the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, so I'm certainly not advocating for retrenchment. I should tell your listeners that. But it bears looking at. And a lot of the students who come to Wisconsin go back, or they go to other states. I think we lost something like a negative 60,000 students left Wisconsin after getting a degree here and went to other states. And so that's a real question. There's no quick answer, but it's something that really bears close scrutiny. And it is something people are looking at, and that's good.
All right, Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob. I appreciate it.
That was Michael Flaherty. He's senior lecturer at UW-Madison, and he says Wisconsin should review its college reciprocity agreements. The proposed hog farm in Bayfield County would be the largest in the state if it's ultimately approved by regulators. Activists and tribal groups in the area have raised concerns about the environmental impact of the 26,000 hog farm, while the company, Reich's View Farm, says it's aiming for high levels of compliance with environmental regulations.
This week, the state DNR announced that it will conduct an environmental review of the project, a move that both the company and its critics have welcomed. Danielle Kading has been covering that story. She is a WPR reporter based in Superior, and she joins us with the latest. Danny, welcome back.
Thanks, Veronica.
Well, the DNR announcement is the latest development in this story. What would happen in this environmental review?
Well, they'd be looking at a variety of different topics that would be submitted by the public, including impacts to surface water, groundwater, you know, how the manure is going to be managed and things like that.
How much manure are we talking about?
We're talking about, according to the most updated version, they've submitted three so far, Reich's View Farms, to the state, and the updated version says around roughly 9 million gallons a year they'll be producing and spreading across roughly 1,400 acres in the area.
So in a hog farm 101, what happens with that manure? Where does it go?
Well, they're planning to inject that manure into the soil rather than use aerial spraying. And the county passed a ban on manure spraying earlier this year in January. So that would go down into the landscape, and then there's some concern there that, you know, given buildup over time or heavy rain events in that area, which meteorological data says they are now getting heavier rainfalls every year, that there's a great potential for runoff into the surrounding watershed and then from there into Lake Superior.
So let's get a little more background on this. Something like 26,000 hogs potentially at this facility. What is the Reich's View Farm proposing?
Well, they're proposing, like you said, 26,000 hogs. They're planning to build three barns, and their building permit that they've submitted to the county says that would be around $12 million. And so they're planning to do this because they're replacing their farrowing herds in Iowa, in Lawler, Iowa. And so once they get that up and running, then it would be something around the order of 7,500 sows and 14,000 piglets, about.
Now you use the word farrowing herds. What does that mean?
They're replacing their females down in Iowa. They came up here to be more isolated because they're trying to get away from some of the diseases that they're seeing with their swine operations there.
And if you could put this in perspective for us, Danny, at a 26,000 hog farm, how big would that farm be compared to other large capacity farms in Wisconsin?
Well, as you said before, it would be the largest in the state for hog farming. I think there are roughly 12 swine operations or concentrated animal feeding operations currently in the state. And, you know, when you're talking about 9 million gallons of manure a year and spreading that on 1,400 acres or 55 fields, that's a lot of land to cover.
So there's been some local reaction, needless to say, in Bayfield on both sides. And what have supporters had to say?
Well, supporters of this project say that this is the way of things, that the food we eat is produced more and more by these large concentrated animal feeding operations rather than the traditional family farm. And some farmers are also concerned about whether they would be able to grow, saying that regulations from the state would keep them from doing that because of the requirement they'd have to meet with this WPDES permit, or a Wisconsin Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit. It's a water quality protection permit. And another issue is the nutrient management plans. And there's some concern that if the DNR is going to be up here inspecting this larger CAFO, then they're going to start asking questions of smaller producers. So folks like Clay Burdett, he's a farmer in the Mason area. Here's what he had to say about people opposed to this project.
To me, it feels more like an attack on modern agriculture. So anything that you guys keyhole as CAFO or factory farms or anything of that nature is not right. It's modern agriculture and the fact that we've progressed to a point where we can do more production with less effort, and it's just an attack on our way of life.
All right, we heard there from farmer Clay Burdett. And there's also been criticism of the proposed hog farm. Who's opposed to it, and what kind of arguments are they making?
So those opposed to the hog farm are mostly concerned about how it's going to affect water quality, human health, and also the smell. And we've got some local governments like the city of Ashland who are worried about any runoff of manure making its way into the Fish Creek watershed and then down to the Shawangan Bay where they have their water intake. And then you have tribes like Red Cliff and Bad River. They're arguing it's too risky to have that much manure near Lake Superior and that it will affect their ceded territory rights to hunt, fish, and gather. And you have environmental groups as well, like the Wisconsin League of Conservation Boaters and even the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, writing letters expressing concerns over the operation and how that may impact surrounding wildlife, including endangered shorebirds like the piping plover that nest on the islands nearby. And a nonprofit group has also been found in the wake of this called Farms Not Factories. And Mary Doherty is a co-founder of the group. And here is some of what she had to say about the hog farm.
This is an environmentally sensitive region, and 9 million gallons of manure don't fit well with clay soils. That, I realize, is probably somewhat unrealistic since the DNR has never denied a CAFO permit. So I hope that we'll, when we end up with this report, that there'll be plenty of opportunities for public comments where the people that live in this region can weigh in and say, here's some things we're worried about, here's some of the things we think the DNR should consider. And if the proposed Badgerwood CAFO ever does get permitted, that they are held to the most stringent standards possible.
That was Mary Doherty, co-founder of Farms Not Factories, as we talk now with Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter in Superior, talking about a proposed CAFO, a hog farm, 26,000 hogs, which would make it the largest in the state. And Danny, so we heard from Mary Doherty there of this group Farms Not Factories, which was formed in response to this proposed hog farm. How contentious is this issue in northern Wisconsin right now?
It's very contentious. You know, I would say it's the new GTAC. You've got people who are very emotional about this issue because they really care either about the water quality, and then you've got farmers who are very concerned about their livelihood. And this is an area that has seen the number of dairy farms decrease exponentially in the last couple of decades, where now we have only roughly 40 to 45 dairy farms in Ashland and Bayfield counties. And so it's become an issue already of farming against those who don't farm, and they're both trying to steer the conversation back to the facts of what would actually happen if this farm is built.
And how has the company itself, Reichsview Farm, responded?
Well, Reichsview Farms is saying that they want to achieve the highest level of environmental compliance, and that they say this is why they requested the environmental impact statement as part of the permitting process. You know, these permits are supposed to ensure farms use proper planning for managing their manure with these nutrient management plans and have proper storage and practices to protect waters in Wisconsin. And some things they have to do to get a permit is they have to have 6 months of manure storage. And here's Gene Nome. He's a manager with Reichsview Farms talking about their plans for Badgerwood.
We've got a longer than standard storage capacity. The DNR requires 180-day storage. And we've got something that exceeds a year and a half worth of storage. So we've got some flexibility there as well to take advantage of storage when application windows might not be exactly right for the full volume of manure.
So we heard there from Gene Nome, manager with Reichsview Farm, talking about plans for storing the manure as a application would permit for down the road. And Danny, what do you hear in that clip?
Well, you know, as far as Gene Nome is concerned, they're going to do whatever they can to protect the environment. And they say that that's the way they run their operations in Iowa. There's one point I want to raise about the environmental impact statement process. You know, this process can cover a lot of topics, but the permit decision that will be made is going to be based on the standards for that permit. And that is based on the DNR's rules governing CAFO permitting. And so while the EIS is broad, that study is broad, the law governing the permitting is much more narrow. So they can only look at the things that relate to water quality. They wouldn't be able to consider things like air odor, traffic, lighting, or anything else, the only way they can use information from the environmental impact statement is if it relates to what the permit governs.
And the EPA, what kind of response have we seen from the EPA on this?
Well, the EPA has said that they are going to review the DNR's draft permit on this, which they're characterizing, both the state and EPA is characterizing, as pretty standard. The EPA says it does a random sample of these major permits, around 10 to 20 in each state around the Great Lakes every year. So they're going to review the DNR's draft once it's done.
And Danny, did I hear right that one of your sources there said that there has never been a CAFO permit denied in Wisconsin? Is that correct?
Yes. They have been either changed in their application or they've been withdrawn, but the DNR has never denied a permit for one that's been applied for.
And Danny, briefly as we wrap up, what's the timeline on this?
The timeline is going to go, well, span several months. They're going to take input on the things that the public would like to see reviewed. And then they're going to be posting some information on their website so that people can provide those comments.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
That was WPR reporter Danielle Kading talking about this week's DNR announcement of an environmental review of a major hog farm proposal in northern Wisconsin.
The commander-in-chief himself, President Barack Obama, visited La Crosse today. In a speech about the economy and strengthening the middle class, he laid out details for his new plan to expand overtime pay for millions of Americans. Here's the president.
When you drive through La Crosse and throughout Wisconsin, when you see communities where kids are thriving and communities are thriving, it's because everybody has a shot. Everybody's working hard. Everybody's pitching in. That's when we're at our best.
WPR's reporter in La Crosse, Maureen McCollum, is here with us now to talk about the president's visit and what he had to say. Maureen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Maureen, big day in La Crosse. Can you describe the scene there this afternoon?
It was. WPR studios are right next to the building where President Obama was, so I was able to just look out our window and see the line stretching blocks away even early this morning. The first person in line arrived at 3:45 this morning. So to say people were... The people who wanted to go were excited is an understatement. I went out to the airport and watched as Air Force One arrived. And actually, Governor Scott Walker was there to greet him, along with La Crosse Mayor Tim Cabot, Senator Tammy Baldwin, and Congressman Ron Kind, as well as sort of 30 people that were involved in a meet and greet. And, you know, everyone wanted to hear what Obama and Walker were going to say to each other. It appeared very lighthearted and friendly. They were laughing with each other. I could not get my microphone close enough. But I know that Governor Walker did give Obama a La Crosse Loggers jersey, which is our baseball team here. And the only audio I can make out is Walker or is Obama saying, "I'm not going to wear a Packers jersey." So that's all I know about the exchange between those two. But I mean, it appeared very friendly. So,
well, how would you describe the overall message that the president was trying to get across today?
His message overall was essentially, it's going to take strengthening the middle class to really build up our economy. He was really focused on, you know, he touted quite a bit of the, as he would probably say, his presidential accomplishments. He said that the last week in the U.S. has been amazing, was his word, referring to Supreme Court decisions on health care and same-sex marriage. He received standing ovations when he talked about both of those issues. But, you know, he said that those issues kind of play into middle-class issues. He said that, you know, in order to move this economy forward, we need to look and make sure that we're making the middle class happy. What feels good to them? How do we treat workers correctly? And he dove into a number of issues that he's either worked on, you know, such as healthcare reform. You know, he says that is built to help the middle class. He touted clean energy. And he talked a bit about the auto industry, too, and said that I think the U.S. is on track to sell more cars than it has in many years. And he said that's just a sign that our economy is strengthening. And then he laid out a number of other issues that he'd like to see in the future to really move this country forward.
Right. And starting last week, the president's been talking about his plan to expand overtime pay in America. He got at that today again. Here's a little bit of what he said.
We're making more workers eligible for the overtime that you've earned. And it's one of the single most important steps we can take to help grow middle-class wages. It's going to give as many as 5 million Americans, including 80,000 folks right here in Wisconsin, the overtime protections they deserve.
So the overtime pay issue is a new one for the president. Any sense about how it went over today with the people who were there to see him?
The crowd loved it. I think his quote was, "A hard day's work deserves a fair day's pay." And, you know, I think he received a standing ovation on that issue as well. From what I understand, in order to make this a reality, the Labor Department has to craft these changes and essentially implement them. What the exact details are, I think, has yet to be determined. I even talked with Congressman Ron Kind about that. And even our state representative out of La Crosse, Jill Billings, she even said if the federal government reaches any sort of bumps in the road along this issue, it's something that the state legislature could potentially take up. So, you know, how this plays out is yet to be seen, but it seems like Obama is trying to garner as much support as he can for this idea.
We're talking to WPR's reporter in La Crosse, Maureen McCollum, talking about President Obama's visit today. And one thing the president did was compare Wisconsin to Minnesota. What did he have to say on that front?
When he was talking about Minnesota, he referred to a La Crosse Tribune headline. It was in, I think it was an editorial written by the staff a few months back that basically said Minnesota is winning the border battle. He talked about how, I think he referred to the great experiment going on in Minnesota, which asked its top 2% to pay a little more in taxes, and that money is going towards things like kindergarten, and he talked about equal pay and whatnot. But essentially, he said that Minnesota is indeed winning the border battle.
We've got a little bit of that section of the president's remarks as well.
Wisconsin is this extraordinary state filled with extraordinary people. But if you end up having policies that cut education, help folks at the top, aren't expanding opportunity, then it's not going to work. We need better policies.
Now, you get the impression that that is an oblique reference, maybe not so oblique, depending on your point of view, to Governor Walker, who has been in the president's remarks before. Was there any sort of overt tension there between Scott Walker and the president and the policies that they both espouse?
It was interesting because he never mentioned Walker by name, but he definitely alluded to some of the actions that Walker has taken. He talked about cuts to education, to state education. And then I think he made the comment like, does that sound familiar? And everyone started laughing and cheering. He also talked a bit about cutting workers' rights and saying, we remember how this happened in Wisconsin, and diminishing the power of the unions, and how Obama had said that that's not something he believes in. He feels like unions should be there because he believes in power by numbers, you know, to have groups of advocates, you know, working on behalf of the workers. So there definitely was tension there. I mean, he ripped on the Republicans quite a bit. You know, he talked about it in regards to the Affordable Care Act, like, remember when they talked about death panels? Now we're here to celebrate health care reform, and it's the 4th of July and whatnot. So, I mean, he definitely had a lot of words for Republicans. For Walker specifically, not as much, but definitely some references there.
It sounds as though the tone was a little edgier today. As you said, there were some zingers, including this one.
You know, we've got some healthy competition in the Democratic Party, but I've lost count how many Republicans are running for this job. They'll have enough for an actual Hunger Games.
Maureen, did anything strike you about the tone of the president's speech today?
This is only the second time I've seen the president in person. The first time was back in Missouri just a few days before he was elected president in 2008. And, you know, so there you had a campaign. Today, he just seemed relaxed. He seemed confident. It's almost like he, you know, he laid out his policies, things he has accomplished, things he hopes to accomplish soon. And it's almost like he had this air to him that he knows this is working. Whether or not everyone there agreed with him, I mean, the majority there were supporters, but whether or not people agree with him is one thing. But the confidence that he gave off was something.
Now, here we are on the day that Governor Scott Walker has filed his papers with the FEC to run for president. And then here we have President Obama in Wisconsin. Is there anything to that juxtaposition, or is it just incidental?
Oh, goodness. I'm not a political expert on this type of thing. I mean, there, you know, of course, there were a lot of people talking about just the timing and how interesting that was, you know, but I mean, who knows? Who knows why the announcement was made today, and who knows why Obama visited today? I'm sure there's deep meanings that other people could analyze better than I could. But, I mean, it's a really fascinating day in Wisconsin politics.
And the La Crosse Tribune, I understand, did a little poking around, and they found that La Crosse has averaged a presidential visit every 4.5 years since George H.W. Bush passed through in 1992. That's a pretty good track record there for a Wisconsin city of 50,000 people. Yeah. Why do you think La Crosse gets that kind of attention from presidents?
You know, I talked with a political science assistant professor, Tim Dale, about this yesterday, and he said there are a couple of things. One, we're a border community, so right across the river is Minnesota. So, I mean, there were probably many Minnesota residents at this rally today. We also have Iowa just a few miles away, so you have the tri-state region, brings in different media and whatnot. But also, I think you have a strong base of Republicans and Democrats, people who are very involved in the different parties here, who I think have just been big advocates for this region. Maybe logistically it's easy to get around. You know, it's easy for Air Force One to fly in, get to the event, and get back out. But, you know, I mean, La Crosse is kind of your typical Midwestern town, blue collar. It's going through many, many changes right now economically. I mean, the downtown La Crosse is not going to look the same in just a few years. So I think it's just one of those places that could be any town USA. But here we are, you know, in a tri-state region.
Maureen, thanks a lot for joining us today and telling us about it.
Yeah, thanks, Veronica.
That was Maureen McCullum, WPR's reporter in La Crosse. She joined us to talk about President Obama's visit to La Crosse today. Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders visited Wisconsin yesterday. His campaign stop in Madison drew nearly 10,000 supporters, something Sanders himself said was historic.
Tonight, we have more people at a meeting for a candidate for president of the United States than any other candidate has had in 2016. Thank you.
Here with us now to take a closer look at Sanders' visit is Laurel White. She's a reporter at the Capital Times in Madison. Laurel, thanks for being up with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Bernie Sanders, first Democratic candidate to make a stop in the state. Thousands came out to see him. What was his overall message to his supporters?
You know, he touched on a whole slew of things, really, but I think the primary message was income inequality. He said it's the political issue of our time. It's really what he's focusing on, I think.
And a pretty big crowd, but it's a pretty big crowd in Madison. It's maybe a friendly environment for him. Did you get that impression at the event?
Absolutely. And that's what he's doing. I mean, that's the Sanders strategy, right? And his campaign has been pretty open about that. They're going to liberal strongholds all over the country. They just did a rally in Denver. They're going to Portland, Maine, I believe, next week, and they're having to upsize the venue because he's been getting such strong turnouts. So, yeah, I think he was aware of that. He was coming to a liberal stronghold.
And he was aware that he was coming to a state that's going to be home to another presidential candidate, Governor Scott Walker. How much of the speech referenced Governor Walker?
You know, that was interesting. He did make a couple jabs at Governor Walker, but it wasn't incredibly frequent. He mentioned Governor Walker's opposition to raising the federal minimum wage, and he said that that was something obviously that he would support. I believe he said $15 an hour was what he supports. And he mentioned Governor Walker one other time, just kind of lumping him in with Republicans and saying the message we are sending here tonight with this powerful grassroots movement is that the wealthy and powerful aren't running this country. The people are going to take back the country.
And here's a clip of Sanders referring to Wisconsin's Act 10, that budget reform bill ended most collective bargaining rights for public employees. Let's give a listen.
When you deny the right of workers to come together in collective bargaining, that's extremism.
So again, related to the income inequality issues you mentioned, did he play a lot on that union theme?
He did. And he said the extremism comment was particularly interesting because he said he was welcomed to Wisconsin by a billboard with him on it that called him an extremist. So he was sort of reframing in that comment, you know, what I stand for isn't extremism. What the Republican Party has been doing and what Governor Walker has been doing with Act 10 and things like it is extremism.
Now, of course, he isn't running against Governor Scott Walker right now. He's running against it's up the field up to five, I think, announced House Democratic candidates, including mainly the likely winner, people say, Hillary Clinton. Did he talk about her at all in this speech?
He didn't. I think that everyone's trying to keep the focus on Bernie and not talk about Hillary. I actually listened in a little bit on an organizer's meeting with volunteers, and they said, if anybody asks you about Hillary, we're not talking about her. We're here to talk about Bernie. We're here to focus on Bernie. And I think Bernie was too.
Now, you talked to some people who attended the event outside of the organizers. What did they have to say about why they were there?
They were just incredibly excited. I think that the progressive base really came out. I talked to people who came from Illinois, who came from far reaches of Wisconsin, driving 3-4 hours. And they were saying, you know, he has a strong history of saying things that he means and being consistent. That was a message I heard frequently walking up and down the line. His positions haven't changed. He has integrity. And he seems to value human life over money. That was another theme.
And did the people, the attendees here, did they talk about Hillary Clinton when you talked to them about why they were there? As though they were looking for an alternative.
Sure. You know, they didn't much. When I would mention Hillary and say, you know, hey, how are you feeling about fundraising? Hillary's doing so well. I think a lot of people presume that she's, you know, it's a signed, sealed, delivered kind of deal with her. And they said, you know what? That's not what we believe. And we have faith that us being here shows that there's a shot for Bernie. And, I mean, we saw the polls coming out of Iowa today that I think he's doubled his numbers in Iowa. He's catching up to Hillary. So that's probably heartening for those folks that were standing in line for hours yesterday.
And he had done well, some people said surprisingly well, in the Democratic state convention straw poll. He didn't beat Hillary Clinton, but posed more of a threat than people anticipated.
Yeah, I believe he was within 8 points of Hillary, which was surprising. I think a lot of people have been pointing out with that, though, that straw polls like that often play to the base. And so he is a candidate, certainly, and that's something we saw last night that really appeals to the base liberal voter. The themes that he's speaking to really appeal to that person.
Now he's running for the Democratic nomination for president. As a senator, he's not a Democrat. He's an independent.
Right,
this something that anybody organizing this, anybody was talking about?
You know what? Nobody mentioned that. There were a couple more mentions of, I think it's fun for people to talk about, oh, he's a Democratic socialist. Mm-hmm. That's how he identifies. But no, it was, you know, it was him within the context of the Democratic field. Hillary, the other Democratic candidates never mentioned, of course.
Talking to Laurel White, reporter at the Capital Times, looking at Bernie Sanders' visit to Wisconsin as part of his Democratic presidential nomination campaign. A lot of news going on in the presidential race here in Wisconsin today with Governor Walker's filing papers that he is going to be a candidate. Official announcement still to come in about 10, 11 days. Momentum. Bernie Sanders trying to build it up from initially being seen as a long shot, I think by most political observers, still being seen as a long shot. Looking at the people here, what they were saying, what he had to say, do you feel that sense of momentum there?
Oh, absolutely. I think that people were really excited. I think one of the things that attendees were most anxious to talk with me about was the attendance at the event. People kept calling that out to me when I would go up and say, hey, what did you think of his message? And they would say, oh, he's so great, but look at all these people. I can't believe that so many people showed up here. And it was a crowd of 10,000. It was the capacity of the venue. And I actually heard that they were turning some folks away at the door. So
that's an interesting phenomenon of American politics. To be taken seriously, you have to prove that somebody's taking you seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the organizers were pointing toward, too?
Yeah, I think that they're trying to prove that there's a movement behind Sanders, and they're hoping that that movement, that national movement, is going to inspire voters in the early states like Iowa, New Hampshire, to take a second look at him. That gives him a little bit more credibility.
Now, maybe it was hard to get into this kind of depth with people who were at this event, but did you get a sense like, hey, we're excited to see this guy talk? Or were people talking like, hey, we're excited to see him talk and go knocking on doors for him, you know, when it comes time for primaries?
Sure. I think that that's actually a really interesting thing that I experienced when I was interviewing folks waiting in line. almost everyone had a specific issue that they were interested in hearing Sanders talk about. So I would say, oh, you know, you're excited to be here today. That's great. What are you looking forward to hearing the senator address? And they would say, I want to hear him talk about student loans and interest rates on student loans. I want to hear him talk about raising the minimum wage. I want to hear about his positions on social justice and equality. And that, to me, says that he has a pretty engaged group of people that are coming that are more likely to knock on doors than folks that are just being kind of swept into a current of, oh, my goodness, we have 10,000 people here. How great is that?
And now some numbers came out from the Sanders campaign. He's raised $15 million, not a lot compared to $45 million for Hillary Clinton, but not nothing. Did he talk about fundraising, or did his organizers talk about fundraising and how they're doing?
He did talk about fundraising, and he said, you know, it's clear that we're the underdog here and that we're not going to be able to raise the money from big donors, and we don't want to raise money from big donors. He said that we are pulling together a grassroots movement, and that number that came out today, that $15 million, I think 99% of those donations were under $250, which is something that people are really commenting on. So, yeah, he's talking about fundraising, and he's talking about getting it from the little guy. That's his focus.
So that and the income inequality, anything else in his message that struck you?
I think just the populism and the unabashed progressive message of the speech was really striking. It was almost like a wish list of what a progressive would want to hear. He hit on 9-10 different things. By the end of the hour-long speech, it was quite a long speech, you sort of felt like, gosh, wow, this must have been cathartic for a lot of people to hear. And I think that's what drew people from around Wisconsin. It was a real progressive's dream.
So this was a dream audience, too, for this particular candidate. Wisconsin is not an early primary state. Do you think we're going to hear much more from Democratic candidates, given that we're not the early deciders in this primary?
I don't know. It's hard to say how Sanders' appearance here and the obvious impact it's had. You know, it's been covered in national media. I think Madison was trending on Facebook this morning. I don't know how other candidates are going to take that. Maybe Bernie's going to bring us everybody else.
And on the Republican side, do you think there's maybe some kind of similar analog, probably not Madison, but elsewhere in the state, where a candidate might come and be able to pull up a big crowd?
Well, sure. I think that that's a distinct possibility. And Wisconsin is a real hotbed for politics these days, as we all know. I think some Republican candidates might be interested in treading a little bit on Scott Walker's turf. And that could lead to some drama. So we might have a story coming there, I think.
All right, Laurel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Laurel White with the Capital Times joining us to talk about presidential candidate Bernie Sanders and his campaign stop here in the state.